Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to look at two issues. They actually are connected, but for most people, they're clueless on both. And I'm concerned that our lack of knowledge is going to impact us in a negative way. One is the war on our savings, the bail-ins, the push to go cashless, the idea that we can trust the government regulators and the major corporations to look after the financial stability of our lives. Historically, we believe that. I grew up in a conservative small town in West Virginia on the banks of the Ohio River called Parkersburg. The whole county only had 44,000 citizens when I was growing up back in the 1960s. People put their money in the bank and they received a nice interest on that money. I knew no one who had debt. The only debt people had was a 2% mortgage on most of the homes because most of those homes were from the GI loan, and you could get a 2% GI loan to build a home. The average cost of a home was $8,000, $8,000 in 1945. And so by the 1960s, that home was worth probably around $50,000. Real estate increased about 1.5% per year. You generally worked at one to two jobs your entire life after high school or college. And we didn't have credit cards. And so people prided themselves, at least my family, that came from the greatest generation, born or raised during the Great Depression, suffering those years plus the privations of the Second World War, in saving. The net savings in my home were about 18%. And when I asked my mom about all the ways that she would save money, and we had piggy banks as kids, she said because during the Great Depression, those families that had not saved and would work with others in co-ops, clothing co-ops, food co-ops, mechanical co-ops, they suffered. And as a result, there was this measure of character of helping your neighbor, helping yourself, and being conscious. And I remember my Aunt Virginia once told me, she said that she was a young officer, the youngest officer at the Parkersburg National Bank, and one day during the Great Depression, the bank president met with her and said, you're going to have to let these people know that we're foreclosing on their home. And there were a bunch of names on this list, she said, and she said, I will not do this, nor will you do this. And this was something that generally didn't happen, where the president of a bank is told by an underling, we're not going to do what you say. And she explained, these are the people that sit with us in our church. And how am I supposed to go in that church, you go into that church, and sit there knowing that the people sitting beside you were good citizens who fell on hard times and you took away their home? I will not do that. I'd rather quit this job, and you will be shamed. Realizing in small communities, shame is a big issue. And hence, you don't want your children doing something wrong because it's going to come back on you. And so people stuck together, and no one was dispossessed, my aunt said. Look at that then, and now look at it today, where we don't have savings. We have debt. We have corporations that are not there for us to work and give our time and loyalty, and in return have a living wage with savings, and to be able to have several generations, many generations, work at a company. All that ended in the mid-1970s. And since that time, more than 30 million Americans have lost their jobs by companies being taken over through leveraged buyouts by major financier groups, hedge funds, and equity partnerships. And more often than not, what is really being purchased is a trademark. They don't want to make the sewing machines or dishwashers. They want to have the name that people recognize and then have India or China or some other country that has very cheap labor and no environmental standards, no workers' rights, make that, bring it back, and sell it in a box store. The fate of that consumer is not relevant unless you're that consumer. But then here's the irony, and it is so bizarre, it kind of reminds me of the Stockholm Syndrome, where the people who once worked and were gainfully employed and had a quality of life, were not in debt and had savings, they've lost their jobs, so they go into that box store to buy the cheap foreign-made products, frequently that they don't need, using credit and sometimes usurious rates, where they say they give you back, oh, we'll give you back 1.5% or 2%, but you're getting a minimum of 18%, so who wouldn't give you back 2% if they got to keep 16%? No matter how you look at it, they're ahead. And the payday loans can go 700%, 800% interest. You never get out. That's debt peonage. And then when you're in debt, they now have debtor's prisons that I discussed at length in our last program. So when I think of what life was like growing up when I was a kid, and then I think of what life is like for many kids today and their parents, so much has changed. So we're going to look at this through the eyes of Professor Ellen Brown. She's an economist. She's an attorney in Los Angeles, who is the founder of Public Banking Institute, a nonprofit economic venture to find viable, sustainable solutions to America's banking crisis by promoting people-owned state and community banks. Last year, she ran as the Green Party candidate for California's state treasurer. And she has written extensively about the private financial cartels and the Federal Reserve. And she has a book called The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity, which introduces a safe, soluble public banking alternative to the credit-based system of the current big banks. Her writings have appeared in Center for Global Research, where she is a research associate. She also hosts a radio program. It's called It's Our Money, heard every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Her website is webofdebt.com. Later, we will be joined by Professor Guy McPherson. Now, what does Guy McPherson in New Mexico, who is a professor emeritus of natural resource and ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona, one of the most outspoken environmental experts in the world, what does that have to do with debt? I believe that climate change will impact our resources, our biodiversity, our agriculture, our water, our social infrastructures, and the economy. And yet it's not being discussed. We will discuss the tipping points. How many are there? Which ones have tipped? Which ones cannot be undone? What will it mean if you're living in urban and suburban environments that now are oblivious to any form of environmental problems, unless there is a hot day, a cold day, a rainy day, or a very dry period? They go on with their life because they have controlled environments. I'll explain why they should be concerned. But first, let's go to Ellen Brown out in Los Angeles. Nice to have you with us today, Ellen.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be talking to you, Gary.
Ellen, I would like for you to give us the large overview story. Here is the story I want you to share with us, please. One, a couple of years ago, there was a crisis in Cyprus, and we got a little bit of knowledge of that in the United States, but unless you went out of your way to read about it, it was the beginning of the bail-ins. I want you to explain what happened there and how it's now capable of happening now. From there, we have been told, even today, by everyone from the President of the United States to the head of the Federal Reserve. In fact, there was recently a meeting of the last four, Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan and Yellen and Bernanke, Ben Bernanke, the last four heads of the Federal Reserve, spanning over 40 years, all said, wow, things are really good. And I'm thinking, by what metric? You have $25 trillion in corporate debt. You have $1.2 trillion in student loan debt. You have $980 billion in credit card debt. You have mortgage debt into the almost 12 to 16 trillion, depending upon the figures you use. You have underfunded and unfunded entitlements. You have states that cannot balance their budgets and are billions per state in the hole, representing $5 trillion. Add it all up and you have over $100 trillion in debt against a $16 trillion gross domestic product. That means that we are in a worse position than Greece, Italy, Ireland, Iceland. There is no country that is as bad as we are, and yet we're considered the great place to be, and people are wanting to be in dollars. And I'm thinking, wow, we're printing money that has nothing backing it up. I want you to explain to us why the pundits of this rosy, utopian economic picture are so disingenuous, and the truth of how serious is our debt, and that we'll never get out of it, and also the monster in the closet, derivatives. Four banks in the United States are holding over $400 trillion in derivatives. Explain a derivative, and then explain why that matters because of the bail-in system, that if the banks fail, you can't just go and take your money out, or the FDIC cannot just say, write you a check for everything up to $250,000 that historically it would have. Explain the mess that we're in, and no one is talking about it, including the equity absurdity, the bubble of Wall Street that's now approaching 18,000, where it realistically should be around 6,000. That's a bubble. The real estate market, a bubble. The commercial real estate market, a bubble. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Okay. Starting with Cyprus, where you started, that was a couple of years ago, and two big banks in Cyprus went bankrupt. And normally, the depositors would be covered by deposit insurance. But what happened in this case was that the Troika, that which is the EU, the ECB, and the IMF, required that the government bail in the depositors before the Troika before the European Central Bank would come up with money to help bail out the banks. So originally they were going to take a percentage of all the depositors' money, but there was such a protest over it, the depositors took to the streets, and the government itself said they refused to do it. That was just unprecedented, and it would ruin their reputations as banks, etc. So they finally compromised and took 50% of the money of the depositors over the deposit limit, which was is 100,000 euros in Europe. So that broke like a lot of businesses. That's who has big deposits in banks are typically businesses, because they need money for their cash flow. They have to meet payroll and pay suppliers, so they keep money in the bank in order to be liquid. And so many businesses went under, and other businesses had to lay off a lot of workers. So it was devastating on the economy, and they still haven't recovered. But that was the shot across the bow, and it was actually testing the model, the bail-in model, which was established in 2010 by the Bank for International Settlements, the Financial Stability Board, which is a wing of the Bank for International Settlements that all the G20 nations agreed to be bound by in 2009 after the 2008 collapse. The G20 met in London, and everybody shook hands. I'm sure they had no idea what they were shaking hands on, and agreed to be bound by this agency that was not elected, and it was very broad what powers they had and very non-specific, so they could basically regulate anything having to do with banking. So now we have the bail-in model, which now it's official. As of the fall of 2014, the G20 met again in Australia, and everybody shook on it, and yep, that's what we would be doing. Again, they probably didn't know what it was just over a weekend, photo ops, everybody smiles and shakes and agrees on it. And just now in 2016, the EU is implementing their new rules, the 2016 rules. And just as of last Sunday, April 10th, the first of the bail-ins happened. So this was under the new rules. There were actually bail-ins last year as well, but under the new, more stringent rules, the first happened in Austria, which is considered a solvent country, not when it's not Greece, it's not one of your bankrupt countries. But the bank that went bankrupt, it was a good bank, bad bank situation. So they didn't have any depositors. They had bondholders. But the bondholders thought that their bonds were guaranteed by the province. But the province said, sorry, they bailed them out. They'd already bailed out this bank before, and they'd already put four times their tax take, or the tax take for 4 years had already gone into this bank, and they said that was it. They weren't going to put any more money into it. And last December, I guess, they had actually made a proposal to the bondholders that they would buy them out, buy the bonds back for less than full value, and the bondholders wouldn't do it. So now the bondholders are going to take a serious haircut under the new rules. And then you know what's going to happen. It's going to go to court, and then the TPP will come along, or the TTIP in Europe, and the corporations will say you can't change the rules by changing the law. You know that the corporations are above the law. The corporate profits are above the law. That's what the TTIP and the TTP are all about. So that's what we have. It's a battle between corporate profits and bank profits and government, which foolishly agreed to bail out these banks in the first place. So that's why they even have these deals where, I mean, there's a question whether they should have even, we should even have deposit insurance. That goes back to 1933. That has made our banks solid, so people are willing to leave their money in the banks. But it is also, now that they've gotten rid of Glass-Steagall, which separated investment banking from depository banking so that the banks are allowed to gamble with our money, this deposit insurance just gives them, you know, a free rein to do whatever they want because they know that they're not going to get sued because the depositors will be covered by the government. But that means we, the people, have to bail them out when they have a huge derivatives bust, as you mentioned, about the derivative exposure of the banks. For example, J.P. Morgan has, I think, over $60 trillion in derivatives, and Citigroup is up there as well, and Goldman Sachs. And they all have many, many times the derivative exposure that they have in deposits. So if they were to go bankrupt, because under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives go first in a bankruptcy, the derivatives claimants, who are largely banks, could snatch all the collateral and there wouldn't be anything left for the FDIC or the depositors or the state and local governments, which is something we worry about in the Public Banking Institute. So they would have to hit up the government. The government does have a credit line up to $500 billion, but who's going to pay that debt back, first of all? It would be the premium holders, the other banks, and that would break those banks. So anyway, we the people are on the hook, no matter how you look at it. The deal is the banks get to ride away into the sunset with their profits, no matter what, and we have to come up with the difference. So we need to change the system, and it seems to me my solution would be, for the whole European issue, it seems to me they could fix that quickly by nationalizing the banks, but previously when they have nationalized the banks, they have then undertaken to pay off the debts, but they don't need to do that because we now know the Bank of England has acknowledged that banks do not lend their depositors money. They create the money they lend on their books. So if what they were lending was merely bank credit, that credit could be written off, just like the Chinese have done for decades, very secretively. That could be written off, and nobody would be hurt. And the reason nobody would be hurt, I mean, you might think, well, that would be inflationary, but it actually wouldn't, because that money is already out there. The money that was created in the form of loans, it's already out there competing for goods and services, and we already don't have inflation. And the depositors aren't going to have any more money than they thought they had. They thought they had X in the bank, and they will still have X in the bank. So So they're not going to rush out and start spending money they weren't going to spend before. So it's going to have zero effect on prices. And if it were to make people feel a little more confident about their deposits and maybe go out and spend, that would be a good thing. They're trying to get people out there to spend. That's what stimulates economies. There is not enough demand, meaning there is not enough money chasing goods and services, not enough people in the shops shopping. So a simple solution, which I'm going to write about in my next article, but don't know that anybody will listen.
Ellen, it's important that you explain this to people. We have been led to believe, starting in 2007, that these banks were too big to fail, and that if any of the big banks failed, J.P. Morgan, for example, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, that the entire economy would suffer and collapse. And yet, when you study the economy, you realize we don't have a single economy. We have multiple economies. And most of what Wall Street represents is an insulated economy where they're not making money off loans to small businesses. Rather, they are making money off money and these exotic derivatives and credit default swaps. And they're not building factories. They're not supporting local businesses. They're not rejuvenating ghost towns and rust belts. They're doing nothing to help the average person. They are completely self-absorbed. So why not allow them all to go through structured bankruptcy, let their stockholders suffer the loss, and then have localized banks that aren't too big and change the way that our bailout system works so we don't bail out any more banks? Because right now, if there's a recession, and I believe that there's going to be another recession, a major recession coming, and all the indicators are there because, quite simply, people are not spending money because they don't have it. 75% of Americans and 75% of the people around the world simply do not have disposable income. So what money they're spending through debt. So they're buying things on their credit cards. Sometimes it's necessary to pay the bills using credit cards. But our economy then says, you see, we're prosperous. Look how much people are spending. And I'm saying, no, those are frequently people who are heavily in debt. What they're spending is creating debt. And the people benefit, the people who got the purchase, a store, a restaurant, or a payday loan or utility bill. But that's not helping the economy. So you're not giving people a living wage. You're not helping people by forgiving student debt and forgiving interest on all these loans. We could forgive our entire interest on the national debt if we chose to, but we won't because we don't want to take any profit away from the banks. So I believe that that we should completely change our perception of the significance of Wall Street and the major banks. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But I can see the problem with if you just let those big banks fail. I mean, if you think of all the things they're tied into, and then there's the derivatives. The derivatives are bets. So as soon as their bets look shaky, they are legally entitled. The derivatives players, the bettors, the gamblers, are legally entitled to rush in and grab the collateral. So I can see where it would be a big mess to let one of those giants fail. I mean, they really do have a gun to our necks in a certain way. But to me, the solution would be to nationalize them. In other words, leave the bank where it is, but we become the owners, write off the debts, that like don't pay them, just write them off. It's not important. Let that money be out there. It's already out there, and we already don't have enough money circulating in the economy. And I would say void out the derivatives. We don't need derivatives at all. Just make them all null and void. They're all just bets, and just void out the bets and go from there.
Also, people don't realize with a derivative, let's say you're Goldman Sachs and you have $60 trillion in derivatives, you did not invest $60 trillion. You didn't even invest 1% of that. And yet if they win, they expect to be paid the 100%, the full $60 trillion. This is the public is being manipulated by people who realize economics is not an important issue for most people. Next, I'm very much opposed to a cashless society. Because if you do not have cash as a form of exchange, then if it's all based upon computer-controlled and centrally controlled accounts, then if you're on someone's no-fly list, if you're on someone's social activist enemy list, if you're on a domestic surveillance list, they could, if they chose, keep you from being able to use the money that you did have available, and in which case, how are you going to buy anything? How are you going to get on an airplane? How are you going to go to the store and purchase food if they tied up your account? And they're fully capable of doing this. They're already monitoring every single citizen. This is not specious or speculative. This is factual. They already have a list of everyone who has issued protests, either over the internet if you protested, signed petitions, or showed up at any rally for anything. If it involves protesting the government, any agency, or any corporation, you're on an enemies list, a domestic enemies list. They're really, they even go as far with the FBI of considering you a domestic terrorist if you're a pro-environmentalist. So now these are the very same agencies and people who are completely unpatriotic and un-American, in my opinion, sociopaths, technocrats, bureaucrats, oligarchs, totalitarianism, and they want to control your capacity to spend money? No, that would be insane. Your thoughts?
Yep, and I agree with that too. And we've seen it happen, for example, I mean, this is an extreme example, but for example, Gaddafi had a lot of gold held in the U.S., in Wall Street, and it's gone, and a lot of money. So we just decide that we're going to impose sanctions, and then we take the money that's in our banks, held in our banks. There's no right of contest. You know, there's no court where you can go and dispute whether you were actually guilty of whatever you got penalized for. So you could see them doing that to any. Well, you see it in the movies all the time. You go and try and use your card, and they say, sorry, there's a hold on your card. You can't spend, and so then how do you eat? I agree. We need some form of currency that is not dependent on a big computer system that could be shut out. Or alternatively, we need a really sincerely honest government, which, you know, is possible in some distant time.
In a distant time, long after the Earth has gone extinct, but not any time before then. I don't believe that anything in the government is capable of being reformed. I believe I'm against the entire government, all of its agencies, and all of its heads, because they're not there to work on our behalf as originally understood. We are now prisoners of the government. And if you doubt me, you think you own your home, don't pay your property tax. You no longer own your home. You think you own your home, don't pay your mortgage. The banks or the mortgage holders own your home. I mean, everywhere you look, someone is trying to declare sovereignty over our rights. And the average person is oblivious to this. Young people, they can't even comprehend the concept. And a lot of people, our generation, baby boomers, they're indifferent to it. They're in their old comfort nest places, and they don't want to be disturbed. You go to a gated community anywhere in America, and you got 40 million people living in them. Ask them how many of you committed to doing anything actively against any form of social injustice, and you get these kind of, we're here enjoying our lives. Why do you expect us to go out there and do anything that causes us any discomfort? So who exactly is supposed to make the changes that we need?
Yeah, and I saw that they're talking about in Europe, talking about raising the retirement age to 75. Can you believe it? You pay in for your retirement all your working life, and then 75 is somewhere around the life expectancy. So you work until you die, and you never get to retire, which means you never have time to write books and do radio shows and do activist things, you know, to change things.
Final thoughts on, I'd like your input on what we should do that's more radical to try to break the hold of those who have power over us. What are your suggestions?
Well, we are on the edge of a revolution, it looks like. I mean, you've got Bernie Sanders, who's was a declared socialist, and you've got Donald Trump, who is has said he's going to invest, like cut the military by 50%. That's absolutely unheard of. Nobody has ever had that, the nerve to say that before. I mean, he's said many things. He says that that they're going to go for single payer, going to go for the most efficient way to do health care, which means single payer and making deals with the drug companies. None of this allowing them to charge what the market can bear, et cetera. So we have a revolution on our hands already. And then in England, you have Jeremy Corbyn, and there have been a number of leaders who have attempted at least populist revolution, you know, revolutions on behalf of the people against this sort of corporatocracy that has taken over governments everywhere in the Western world. So it seems to me there's really hope for changing the system, and that's why I keep writing. I have ideas for how we could change it, and one would be to we don't need to continue to balance the books of those banks. You could write off those debts, and you could write off the debts of the students. You could write off, you know, the debts of the underwater homeowners, and it would actually be good for the economy. And I think I can come up with the math to prove it. But you would have to. You don't want to let the banks remain private because you don't want them to get away with that. In other words, they need to be. The whole deal needs to be taken over, not just their losses.
I appreciate those are all very constructive. I would add some additional ones. I would say that between now and an American Spring, that is a combination of young idealists and older. One-time idealists, the baby boomers joining with the younger generation, that in between that, we could do the following. We could take our money out of their banks. We could stop using their credit cards. We could stop going in their box stores. We could stop buying anything that's not made in America or fair trade. We could go organic and local. We could join food co-ops and farmers markets that have local grown food and reduce our footprint. We can go vegan. That would be an enormous blow because it's a $200 billion a year meat industry, and that's not including the eggs and dairy industry. We could become more conscious and not buy anything we're not going to use. Stop buying stuff. We don't need the stuff we buy. 90% of the things we buy we don't use within 6 months. And we've got to turn off the television. We've got to stop reading the New York Times and some of these other, you know, propaganda pieces. We've got to turn off the Rush Limbaughs. I heard him today saying that there's no such thing as man-made global warming, that there's no proof. Well, my concern is not Rush Limbaugh, the bloviator. My concern is an audience that would actually listen to him. You know, that's a scary thing. When you're listening to Bill O'Reilly and you're listening to these people, because they claim to be patriots, they're not. They claim to believe in the Constitution. When was the last time you saw Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, take their people, their audience, to Washington, chain themselves around the White House or a federal building, and protest and stay there, being arrested until change was implemented? They haven't, and they're not going to. So we need to physically engage by discontinuing the way of life we've been led to believe is important, because it's not. We've got to make change. Get paper. Everything in paper, or take your own shoulder bag and get your groceries. Stop buying plastics. Stop using plastics. You know, do the things that we can do. Now, that may seem insignificant, but if you realize that if every American went meatless one day a week, that's a huge amount of methane that we're protecting ourselves from. So I would add these to the ones you suggested. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I totally agree on those. Yep, great idea.
Good. Well, Ellen, we look forward to your articles. Ellen is always writing about how we can take back power. Professor Ellen Brown, she is an economist and an attorney, and she's also on the Progressive Radio Network every Wednesday at 3 o'clock. Her website is Web of Debt, and her book, The Public Bank Solution from Austerity to Prosperity. Thanks for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you. Great talking.
I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going over and look at another part of this problem of our economy, but we're looking at it through the eyes of an environmentalist. Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, University of Arizona. He specializes in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change and its economic consequences. He's also been a professor at Texas A&M University, University of California, Berkeley, and he is the author, along with his co-writer, Carolyn Baker, of Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. He also co-hosts a radio program, Nature Bats Last, heard every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. His website is GuyMcPherson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Guy.
Thanks for the opportunity. I look forward to our chat.
Guy, I was listening today to... I was driving, and I wanted to hear what Rush Limbaugh had to say. I can handle it for about a minute and a half to 2 minutes. And he was ranting on about how all the Democrats and liberals believe in global warming, but there is no such thing as man-made global warming. It's all a lie. It's a fraud. There's no science, etc. And I'm thinking, does he have any concept of the economic consequences of any of the tipping points? Is he aware of what it means to be promoting living in California when California is not sustainable? It's running out of water. And the measures to conserve water initially were around 25%, but now they're down into the teens, low teens, and it's just not going well. And millions of people have property there that they used to have a quality of life. Now their grass is gone. The shrubs, the plants are gone, unless they replace them with native species that don't require as much water. But they're also living in an unsustainable place. They had an oasis in the middle of the desert. Now they have a aesthetically a pleasing desert that they're living in. It's no longer the oasis, and they're not looking at this. So how can you tell people to live there? How can you tell people to live in most of Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Kansas, Nevada, when these are not sustainable? That's just one concept. And yet people in major cities from New York to San Francisco, they're looking at its boom time in San Francisco. Unless you're very rich, you can't even afford to rent in San Francisco. But if you tell them, you're also, are you aware that you're renting a place that could be destroyed by multiple factors? They don't care. So it seems like we're indifferent. In fact, the latest public poll showed that of the top 10 things Americans are interested in that concern them, global warming or the environment isn't in the top 10. So I'd like for you to do the following, please. I'd like for you to give us a primer on climate change's tipping points that climatological scientists, such as yourself, have reached about what is likely to happen or is happening, and how will it impact us? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. That's a great couple of questions. I don't watch much television, and including this show that has already run its course, The Newsroom, on HBO. It was an Aaron Sorkin written television show, but I did see one 4 or 5 minute clip from that show in which an EPA specialist comes on to the show, and the anchor for the newsroom asks him a question and about climate change. And he answers in a most unexpected manner. He says, a person has already been born who will suffer from catastrophic collapse of the climate of Earth. This aired in November 2014. And then the anchor went on to ask, what does this look like? And the person playing the EPA specialist says, well, it looks like 80-foot sea level rise is already locked in. He didn't mention that 6 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise is already locked in. He mentions mass migrations, which really is a massive refugee crisis. Not migration. The people who are moving are not going back. He talks about food and water shortages. He talks about spread of deadly disease. He talks about endless wildfires. And he talks about superstorms that have the power to level cities and bring permanent darkness. What he fails to mention is that all those things are currently happening. That the mass, quote, migrations he mentioned Well, look around. Africa, Europe, the Middle East, Mexico, the South Pacific, people are already fleeing places that have run out of habitat for human beings. You can't grow food there, and so you can't live there. When does California make the list? Well, some places in California have already made the list. When does it increase at scale? California was saved to a great extent by this massive El Nino, one of the three largest ever recorded, that brought a lot of rain and filled the reservoirs. But it's they're still not full, of course, and the precipitation was less than was actually needed to reinvigorate the vegetation in the area. Food shortages are underway in many places, and they are coming home here as well. You know, during the global financial crisis, 2008-2009, the United States sold all of its wheat reserves, all of its grain reserves. So this is like using the furniture as kindling to build a fire to get through a winter's night. So we don't have any grain reserves left in this country. Food shortages are occurring in places like Syria, water shortages in Sao Paulo and India. There's an article that appeared just yesterday at Reveal. It says, here's the headline, we're running out of water and the world's powers are very worried. Well, yeah, they're worried because there's not enough water to grow food. People are standing in line for hours in some places to get water. You really think we're going to have Olympic Games in a place that the water is contaminated so badly that it's not safe to drink? The spread of deadly disease was the next topic the guest on the television show brought up. And here we're thinking of things like malaria and dengue and Lyme and Zika. These are deadly diseases that are already spreading well beyond the places where they were expected to spread. Faster than expected is the catchphrase for climate change anymore. Endless wildfires, Australia, Canada, United States, Indonesia, all have had record-setting years. In the United States, last year, 2015, was the most acres ever recorded to have burned in the United States in a single year. And superstorms? Katrina was a big deal. And since then, since the superstorm of the millennium Katrina hit in 2005, just a little over 10 years ago, we've had Sandy, Haiyan, Winston, Patricia, and the hits keep coming. So climate change is threatening human existence already in places all over the planet. NASA reported that it took the first 265 years of the Industrial Revolution, from 1750 until October of 2015, for the global average temperature of the planet to increase by 1 degree Celsius. In the following 4 months, global average temperature of the planet increased 0.57 degrees Celsius. If you want to talk about exponential growth, that's where we're at. Even before climate change became evident and we had entered the arena of abrupt climate change, even before that happened, we were already in overshoot on this planet. And places like California are just the glaring examples of human population overshoot, of too many people trying to consume too much in too short a period of time. So I think that's the dire state of our dire straits at this point.
Guy, the people who are closest to many of these events are those that work in natural resources, farmers and fishermen. They're eyewitnesses to the impact of climate change already underway that you just mentioned. But for the hundreds of millions of individuals in the United States and in Europe and other countries living in urban and suburban areas, aside from the weather reports, warmer days or more extreme weather events, life in the city continues as normal. It's more difficult for urban dwellers to understand the full seriousness of the predicaments we face. So what would you say to those who live in large cities? You mentioned Sao Paulo. Well, it's one of the 20 largest cities in the world, and it was a model city It's where their capital is, and it's not Rio. And yet, as you said, and it's absolutely correct, people from every walk of life, from the richest to the poorest, they're out of water in this major city. And you can't pick up and move that many people, 20 million people, to another location overnight. So, and also, you mentioned immigrants. Well, we have had approximately 1.5 to 2 million immigrants, mainly from Libya, a crisis we orchestrated and occurred, but NATO carried out. It was mainly Hillary Clinton's war. Also in Syria, also in the poorest nation in the Middle East, and also in Lebanon, but also the war that Saudi Arabia and the United Emirates and Kuwait and Qatar and others are waging in Yemen. That's where all those people are coming from. Now, what is the latest statistic of environmental immigrants, people who, as you said, no longer can plant their food? 300 million. And what is it supposed to be within 2 years? 600 million. Where exactly are we supposed to put 300 million people? Now, mind you, they're not close to Europe. They don't have the money or the means to get to Europe. So they're wandering around Africa. But the huge number are dying every day, and the world isn't paying attention. The most severely distraught people in Africa right now are in Ethiopia, mainly because of a corrupt government, but also you've got over 12 million Ethiopians who are in imminent risk of dying because of malnutrition. Not a single word about this. So you got 300 million people who are going to end up somewhere, and these are not people who are going to be happy about the fact they have no water, and they have no land, and they have no resources, and they have no seeds. They have nothing, and they're starving. And they're going, at some point, you're going to see a flashpoint on this. In fact, 32 cities around the world had food riots in the last 3 years. None of this reported in the United States. In fact, the largest protests in South America happened just a month ago in Brazil, where they wanted the president out. They wanted the former president Lula indicted because the entire government is corrupt, because they're in free fall. The Amazon is being destroyed, and they're suffering starvation, polluted water, and the economy's tanked. They're deep in debt, and it's not coming back. And yet we didn't report upon 3.5 million people taking to the streets. Now, that's a big demonstration for one city, and yet not a word in the American media. All these are connected because they are part of environmental issues and economic issues that are intimately tied. So tell us about people living in cities who somehow think they're immune from it all.
Well, that's right. Cities, by their very nature, by their very definition, are ultimately unsustainable because they rely upon resources such as food and water and clean air to come from places outside of the city. So the more people you have packed into a small space, the worse the overshoot is in that small space. But it's not as if cities are depending upon what's happening in the city. Even Havana, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Havana, Cuba, with massive renovation in a very short period of time of the government and the entire society, within a couple of years, called the especial period, the special period, about 50% of Havana's food was grown within the city limits. Well, there's a couple of things going for Havana in that case. The climate and the soils are good for growing food. The society was turned upside down with a dictatorial regime that focused almost exclusively on two factors, public health and growing food. And so even with all that going for it, Havana is today able to grow about 50% of its food within its city boundaries. But we aren't doing that anywhere in this country. We don't have the environment for it. We don't have the political will for it. And the media certainly are not helping. I'm going to read a summary for you of an article written by Professor John McMurtry It appeared at The Ecologist, and it's titled Genocide, Ecocide, and the Empire of Chaos. It came out about a week ago. And the summary goes like this. The true nature of Western civilization is hard to grasp from within because we perceive it through media whose primary purpose is not to convey the truth, but conceal it. What is actually playing out is a global war of empire and capital against the Earth and her people, backed up by the omnipresent threat of overwhelming force. That's what we're dealing with. And you're never going to read that in the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is structured, as the article goes on to explain, to mislead, to be the propaganda force that the media in its various forms have become. So I would argue that all writing is propaganda. It's intended to sway your opinion one way or another. But there is no more blatant example than the misdirection, obfuscation, and missing information from the media, the mainstream media in the United States today. We just are not getting the information that is relevant to most people's lives. If we were, I suspect our lives would be structured much differently on an individual, family, and even societal basis. But there's no incentive for the media to present real evidence and tell the story of civilization run amok, of a set of living arrangements that is ecocidal. There's no incentive to do that because there's no money to be made in doing that. It's like telling the patient that they have 3 months to live. Well, they're not going to go out and spend a bunch of money at an expensive store buying clothes, are they? If they only have 3 months to live. Well, and so we're being misled.
Guy, we only have a few minutes. Could you give me some quick, short answers to the following questions, please? I see that with the economic interest, they're not equating anything involving the environment in their formula. And I say, as the environment collapses, implodes, and people don't have water and they don't have good soil, they have catastrophic events, they're going to be moving, and that's going to impact the tax base, and I believe that's one of the reasons that no government is going to tell you the truth about why their state is not sustainable, but it is going to cause an enormous economic challenge when our environment begins to collapse or implode in different sections. Your thought, please.
Absolutely. Greed has become our only god. The only thing that we chase after in this society anymore. And what's coming is going to make the Dust Bowl of the 1930s in the Midwestern part of the United States look like a walk in the park. You can't live without a living planet. There's no ability for humans to survive in the habitats we are creating through the pursuit of money. Bottom line.
Okay, next. I see that none of the current models that are being used to determine the rise of the sea level are accurate. Right now in Miami, every single night, without any rain and without any storms, just the normal tidal surges are flooding a lot of downtown South Beach, and that cannot be corrected because they're an island. There's a bay on one side, the ocean on the other, and yet people are continuing to build in these places. Do you see the rise of seawater coming faster than the model they've given us, thinking, oh, it's 100 years out? And I'm saying it's not 100 years out. It's happening now, and that's going to cause at least 68 million people living in at ocean level, including in Bangkok, in Singapore, in Shanghai, in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in Miami, and other places. They're not going to be sustainable, in part, not because the buildings are going to be flooded, but because the infrastructure at the bottom, your tunnels, your subways, your water lines, are going to be contaminated or blocked. Your thoughts?
Well, yes, and not only all of the above, but there's intrusion, saltwater intrusion, into the freshwater lens that those cities rely upon for drinking water. In addition, it's not merely sea level rise, it's a minor sea level rise, and then the storm surge that comes with the superstorms I mentioned earlier. So it's not that a sea level rise of a foot or two, if it were nice gentle seas, that's not a big problem. But it's not nice gentle seas. It's Katrina and Haiyan and Sandy coming your way on top of minor increases in sea level rise. And what that means is utter catastrophe when the Katrina and the Haiyan and the Sandy show up.
Final quick answer, because we're out of time. Do you see a time schedule that whether we're going to start seeing unusual catastrophic events playing out in what period of time?
I would argue that they're already here with 1.57 degree global average temperature over baseline, and we've clearly gone exponential. When will most people notice? Well, most people rely upon the mainstream media, so I fear that they won't notice until the superstorm is in their own backyard, until the floodwaters are so high that they can't get across the street, and the storm is blowing so badly that it bursts all the windows in the house. That's what I fear, and that's one of the things that motivates my work to get the message out about what's happening around the world that is coming soon to a neighborhood near you.
And when one of these superstorms, Category 5, hits one of the major cities, you're looking at hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion, possibly in damage to New York or to one of these other cities, and there won't be money to rebuild. Guy McPherson, thank you very much for all the good work you do. And Guy's book is radio program is Nature Bats Last, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And his book is Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. Thank you a lot, Guy.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity.
Professor Guy McPherson. So you see, the two do have a connection, our economy and our way we're looking at life economically, but not looking at the environment. And when we don't look at the environment, and we don't think the environment has anything to do with our economy, whoa, that is a mistake. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour.